The blue light.
I'll let you vote on that, Rod.
Good morning, colleagues. I'd like to call to order today's meeting of the Joint Committee on Ways and Means Subcommittee on Education for Tuesday, March 7th, 2017. And I would like to open once again public hearings on Senate Bill 5516 and 5517. And with that, our guests will return to the front of the room.
Madam Chair, I believe we're on slide 102, which is back on the 28th, so the first day that ODE started. Also, we are starting to post the a memo from the department that responds to the questions you had. We'll try to post those on the day that the questions were asked. Now, some of them may come in in the memo that has a few days worth of questions, so you'll have to search around, or we'll let you know where those are. But those are posted also.
Okay, great.
Thank you so much. Proceed when ready.
Good morning. Co-Chair Smith Warner, Co-Chair Monroe, members of the committee. For the record, Salam Noor, Deputy Superintendent of Public Instruction, Oregon Department of Education. And I also wanted to note that we provided you a memo that attempted to respond to your questions from yesterday. We do have some responses relative to the ELD portion of the presentation that we are working on, and we hope to get that to you today. With that, I'm going to turn it over to Brian. I think the plan for today is to continue our presentation on the state school fund and to provide you information on how that process works and how the department engages with schools and districts relative to this tremendous state investment in our schools and districts. So with that, I'm going to turn it over to Brian.
Okay. For the record, Brian Reeder, Assistant Superintendent in the Office of Research and Data Analysis at the Department of Education. Co-Chairs Monroe and Smith Warner, members of the committee, we were about to start in on the section about student demographics. We currently have, well, first of all, start out saying that we count students in various ways for various purposes. One of the most common is what we call fall membership. It's enrollment on October 1st of each year. It's simply a count of students in K through 12 that are served by school districts and ESDs in the state. In the 15-16 school year, the last completed school year that we have, we had 576,407 students on October 1st. Now, we also do a head count of students using the same procedures in the spring on May 1st, what we call spring membership. And typically that number is lower than the fall membership number for a variety of reasons. Some students transfer out, and that often exceeds those who transfer in during the year. We have a number of students, primarily in the high school grades, who leave school either through graduation or some other reason, some dropouts. So the number is a little bit smaller in the spring. We also count, for funding purposes, students by what we call average daily membership and average daily membership weighted. We will get to those counts for funding purposes in a little bit in some of the later slides. The increase, the average increase over, if you look over fairly long periods of time, in fall membership, it has been about 0.5% per year. But this increase recently in 15-16 over the prior year was about double that. So we are growing again. Our enrollment is growing again at a pretty rapid rate right now. If you look about it in the last decade, the last 10 years or so, the total growth, not the annual growth, but the total growth over that period has been about 3%. So sort of somewhat below average for that period, and I think the recession may be one reason for that. We typically, in recessions, lose population both as a state and in our school population, because people often move out of Oregon The recessions that we have in Oregon are often deeper than they are in other states, and so people will move out to look for jobs that they may have lost here in Oregon. Over that period, over the years, we've seen an increased demand for special education. Growth in special education students were more rapid than the general student population, and also as growth in English language learners has grown faster than the general population. Today, a little bit over half of students in Oregon qualify for free and reduced lunch under the federal program administered by the Department of Agriculture. It is one of our key measures of economic status in Oregon. Now, the income levels that are set for students qualifying for a free lunch or a reduced price lunch are different than the standard federal poverty level. They are somewhat higher than the federal poverty level, so we have more students in Oregon who qualify for those free or reduced price lunches than we have students who are technically considered to be in poverty by the federal definitions. And the other rapidly growing group is students of color, primarily Hispanic students in Oregon, students from Mexico and other Hispanic countries, primarily from Mexico in Oregon. They represent 36% of our student population, up about 10 percentage points, up from 26% a decade ago. Getting into the funding formula now, we've talked about the measure that we call average daily membership weighted, or ADMW. It's a count of students plus any additional weights that they get through the scheme that you see here. So special education students get a full additional weight. English language learners are participating in an English as a second language program, an extra half weight. Students who are pregnant or parenting, an extra full weight. Poverty, a quarter weight.
It'd be a good point.
And so on, you can see. And then the last one is important. We call it the small school correction. It provides additional weights to small school districts that have small schools. And the logic there is that it's more expensive to run these very small schools because they have class sizes that are much lower than other school districts, other schools, and so.
Okay. Representative Wisnett.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Reeder, in all the years we've worked on this, I've never asked you or hadn't noticed neglected and delinquent. Can you clarify that, please?
That's a definition of students that the Department of Human Services use for some of their the children that they serve through their programs. And so they provide us a count of students for each district. They're students who, under their definition, which I don't know a lot about what that definition exactly is, but students who are in need of services given the circumstances that they're in their families and in their communities. And so we provide additional weights to school districts that serve those students.
Follow up, please.
Go ahead.
Is it a significant number?
Off the top of my head, I don't know what that number is. It's not a huge number, but it's not insignificant either.
Thank you.
Okay. Representative Parrish.
Thanks. I want to look at that special ed weighting. So they get an additional full weight. And so is that, just help me for my own clarification. So if they get their basic school fund, what's the value and what's the value of that weight in dollars? That's my first question. In the current school funding formula?
Co-chairs Monroe and Smith Warner, Representative Parrish, in this current school year, it's on the order of $7,500.
For one child with an IEP?
That's what each weight is worth. So a student with an IEP has two weights, so they would get twice that amount.
Follow up?
Go ahead.
So does that weight, are we factoring that the level of need around an IEP? And I'll just, in full disclosure, my son's on an IEP. His IEP gives him about 20 minutes a week of reading help. And then, and because he's in high school, they've put him in a prep class to do homework. He'd hate to have me sharing all this story. But the fact is that that seems very different to me than a child who is ambulatory, who needs nursing services, who would also be qualified sort of under that IEP, special ed, needing dedicated health care. I don't think that the value of what my district is providing, if my child's on an IEP and they're claiming a wait for him, is certainly worth $7,500 additional a year for him. And then they've got, you know, some of these higher needs kids. Have we ever sort of broken out what's kind of truly the IEP, like what my son's on, versus the health care side of what we're doing with special ed?
Co-chairs Monroe and Smith Warner, Representative Parrish. Really two parts to that, to my answer to that. We do not, in our funding formula, give different weights for students with different severity of disability. So if you're on an IEP, you get an extra weight independent of what that what the student's disability is. And the, a number of states do break out the data for different disabilities and give different amounts of money for different disabilities based on the very thing you talked about. It's much more expensive to provide services to some disabilities than for others. Oregon has not done that. We've talked about that a number of times here in Oregon, but we have not chosen to do that. We do, however, have a separate fund called the High Cost Disabilities Fund, which provides additional funding for students who are who have very high costs to serve. If their costs are above $30,000, then this fund pays back, reimburses them for that amount, or if there's not enough money in the fund to reimburse them for the entire amount above $30,000, it's prorated across all the districts who have those students.
Last little follow-up.
Go ahead.
I think this sort of speaks to what I was talking about yesterday about that piece around how do we help money follow the child, because for the period of his time where he needed really special services, I'm sorry, we pulled him out of school and had to do that with our private insurance, and he missed a boat ton of school for the 2 years, and certainly on an IEP, he was not getting those services that he needed, and certainly was not the services he was funded for. We paid for those things out of pocket, and they should have been delivered in the classroom. And so that's my concern about that piece about how do we make sure those dollars are getting there, because our district was getting an extra weight for my son and not delivering those services. And I'm curious about how that's playing out across other districts as well. You know, if we're giving out of our funding formula that much money and then not providing services to those kids. And I hear it from parents all the time in my district, and that's why I'm asking those questions.
Madam Co-Chair, Mr. Co-Chair, Representative Parrish, if I may just add to that, you'll have an opportunity to hear from Sarah Drinkwater, our Assistant Superintendent for Student Services, and she is the one that oversees the implementation of the special education programs in the state that are funded both by federal and state dollars. And you'll have an opportunity to hear about how the department engages with districts and monitors the implementation of programs and the supports that are provided to students. So we will make sure we address that in our presentation as well. Thank you.
Senator Robles.
Two things. First, again, it goes back to explain this is a distribution formula, not a formula designed to help individual students. Number two, like you did with the ESL students, have you broken out the amount of money districts are spending on special education programs? I think that would be easier than ESL because there's some other funding requirements to see if, in fact, the amount going to districts that is designed from this extra weight is actually going to special needs schools, because I would assume it would be very similar and that some districts are spending a lot more and some districts are spending a little less based on whatever their individual decisions that the school boards are making. So do we have that information?
Co-Chairs Monroe and Smith Warner, Senator Roblin, we do have that information. It and we have looked at it that way, and we can provide that to you. The one large difference between students on IEPs and students who are English language learners is that there's a great deal of federal law around students with disabilities, and there are what they call maintenance of effort requirements, so that school districts and the state of Oregon have to spend at least as much in a given year as they spent the last year for those students. And so I think you'll find a lot less variation in special education spending than you'll find in spending on ELL students. But it's the same idea, is that we do, our accounting systems do have codes in there for students on IEPs, and that one is a lot more robust than the one for ELL students, because those students, because of the federal requirements, our accounting system has been from the get-go designed around making an accurate count of that. The interest in tracking spending for ELL students outside of specific ESL programs is a relatively more recent thing that we've been attempting to do.
Follow up?
Yep. And we have an automatic deal that if you don't really have to do a lot of proof, if you have 11% of your kids getting the money, you'll get that. If you have more than 11%, you don't get the full weight for every one of
right.
them. And the average for the state is 13% right now. So there are some intricacies, because we had a bill, Canope and I did, that would have added to 13% for the average, because that's what the average is. That changes the total number of distributions, which creates a big problem for all the rest of the schools. So it's an ongoing conversation that's very frustrating to have in changing any of those things because of the way the formula is written. So I guess it is 11 right now. There are 13%. So that then every district can write a program, write to you and say, we have this many extra kids, and hopefully get a little bit more money for that. Isn't that true?
Madam Chair, members, I just wanted to also say, keep in mind the state school fund money earned, as Senator Roblund. There's also $260 million in federal funds for special ed that flow through the grant and aid programs, and actually more than that flows in some real specialized disability-related programs. So you'll be hearing that in the next few days, and that, I think, money is a more targeted, and it can only be used for those federal designated special ed ways.
That's one more.
Rep. Parrish?
Very clear where I'm at philosophically, how money should move to kids. Do other states do it like this, or do other states do it where the appropriation is to follow the child? Do we have any data on how other states are getting this accomplished?
Co-chairs Monroe and Smith Warner, Representative Parrish, we don't have a lot of data on how other states do it. We do know that there's a lot of variation out there. I would argue that Oregon is on the end that has fewer strings attached in terms of how districts are required to spend their money. And there are other states who are on the other end of the spectrum where they have a lot of strings attached. If you look at California, up until a few years ago, they gave out a great deal of their money based on grants, quite a few of them competitive grants, for specific services. And so in that sense, their money was attached to delivering certain services to certain students. They just recently abandoned that system and went to a system much more like Oregon's, where they have a weighted student funding formula rather than giving out a lot of money using grant-related funds. I don't know in their weighted student formula whether they give as much latitude to districts as Oregon does, but they did move away from a system that was highly dependent on grants with lots of strings attached.
I'm just curious if that latitude, if we're on the further end of how much latitude we give, is having that impact on things like graduation rates and success rates, if we're not actually have the ability to hold people accountable for how they spend this money. So.
And then I'm going to take the liberty of asking one last weight question before we move on to the next slide. I wanted to ask about the ESL, the ELL. I know that we passed a bill in 2015 that called for a work group to through ODE to work on how that money was being implemented, all that. And I just wondered if you could give us any information about whether that group has been meeting, what they've been accomplishing.
Madam Co-Chair, Mr. Co-Chair. Thank you for your question, and you'll have an opportunity to hear a lot more detail about this later. But I'll touch on the gist of the question now. So the bill, House Bill 3499, provided resources for the Department of Education to identify districts that are in need of assistance and interventions and supports relative to the EL students based on their performance over a number of years. The bill called for the convening of an advisory committee that has met for over a year. They actually sunset it in December of 2016. So that committee helped us in the identification of the program components, if you will, including the definition of EL students, the time that's considered to be appropriate for achieving proficiency, the accountability that would be associated with the implementation of those sites. We have 40 districts that are currently participating. 25 of them are considered to be transformation districts. Those will require a lot of involvement from the Department of Education. 15 are called target districts, and those require some assistance, but we're also working with ESDs and other partners to support those districts. So the advisory committee convened for over a year and a half, I want to say. So they helped us develop the rules for the implementation of the bill. They helped us develop the program elements, and they sunsetted in December. However, we decided to convene another advisory group. Much of the members of that group will be the ones from House Bill 3499, and including stakeholders, both community and school, including students, teachers, and parents, to continue the partnership to implement this program with fidelity. So that group sunsetted, okay. A new group is being formed. One thing that we were really intentional about is to make sure that we leverage House Bill 3499 and the intention of House Bill 3499 to support our statewide English learners plan. So instead of having one for the federal government, one for House Bill 3499 and a state plan, we've combined them all together so we have one cohesive and comprehensive plan to support English learners, and we're leveraging the resources that the state provided with the federal resources for Title III to make sure that students are receiving the supports that they need in the process.
Thank you. Go ahead, Mr. Reeder.
So this graph shows you both ADMR, which is the R stands for. Sometimes it stands for resident, sometimes it stands for regular, depending on who you talk to. But it's the measure of average daily enrollment or membership before the weights are added. And up until 2015-16, kindergarten students were counted as a half day because that was what was required of school districts. You can see that's identified by the arrows there. The interesting thing about this graph, you can see that back in 1991, when we first started to implement the current funding formula, the difference between ADMR and ADMW was about 15%. In other words, the weights added 15% more to that count. And you can see the growth that occurs up until right in the middle there in 0405, where that difference hit about 24%. And the growth during that period was dominated by growth in English language learners, 300% growth in the weights over that period. The weight didn't change, so that was growth in students. And over that period, the number of poverty weights grew by 41%. So then starting in 0405 and up until today, where that difference is still 24%, ESL weights have been flat. They really haven't grown at all as a percentage of the total. But the poverty weight grew another 26% over that period.
Okay. Representative Wisnett?
And then thank you, Madam Chair. House Bill 3499, I think that's significantly going to change that, and what's going to happen is we will get that'll decrease in the difference, and it'll put more money in the classrooms for everyone. Is because 3499 addresses how long you're in English language learning, so that's going to hopefully that bill will result in a lot more teachers in our classrooms or smaller sizes as we reduce that amount that the ELL's been putting on, taking that extra weight comes out of the big pot.
Thank you. Representative Parrish?
Two questions about weights. One is, how is the poverty weight determined? Is that just strictly like based on free and reduced lunch applications? Or is there some other metric that you use to address that?
Co-chairs Monroe and Smith Warner, Representative Parrish, the poverty weight is actually based on poverty counts by school district from the Census Bureau. So It's not the same definition as free and reduced lunch. It's a, a lower income threshold that you have to be under to be considered in poverty under the federal definition. So it's we don't know that for individual students. It simply is a count from the Census Bureau.
And the second question about the ELL weights, is there criteria from ODE that determines how a student is tagged as ELL? And I ask because we're aware of a family who his father came here from Mexico. Kids were born in the United States. They spoke Spanish in the home, but the kids clearly could speak English. And the school district that they were in tagged them ELL anyway. It was actually a reason for him to get up and run for office because he was pretty upset about it. And eventually, because the school district would not take his kids out of ELL, even though they were native-born children here in this country, he ended up moving his kids to Oregon Episcopal because his kids weren't getting the services they needed. And I'd hate to think that there are districts out there that are tagging kids as ELL that don't need to be in ELL programs simply because of their race. And so I'm curious how we determine who's an ELL child.
Madam Co-Chair, Mr. Co-Chair, Representative Parrish, I'm looking for a slide. I'm giving a presentation on ELLs in the state of Oregon and our state plan and House Bill 3499.
If you're going to get to it, we can wait for it. But
On Thursday, but I do have the slide with me, if I can just locate it very quickly, that may touch on your question in part. So I don't have the specific criteria right in front of me. I can tell you that there is a student identification process, and there are some federal requirements as well as state requirements that drive the identification of EL students. Once a student is identified as EL based on language primarily, the district has an obligation to provide them services. Parents have the option to opt their kids out. I understand from firsthand experience in the Salem-Keizer School District that at times that is challenging for parents. They have a tough time navigating that process to opt their child out of EL services. So we will get you the criteria, and we will be prepared to discuss it when I talk about House Bill 3499 and our EL plan. But what I will tell you is that parents have the option to waive services. So in our state right now, we have a total of 56,869 ELs. The ones that are considered to be current are 54,848. EL students that have waived that service are 2,021. And then there is a breakdown in terms of what level they're elementary, middle, and high. We also have a designation of what's called former EL students. So once you're designated as an EL student, technically you're an ever EL, but you're not necessarily in the program and providing services. The one thing that I would highlight about former or ever EL students, and we have about almost 94,000 of them in the state of Oregon, they perform exceptionally well on academic measures and in graduation compared to the white student population. They actually exceed that. So there is tremendous value in ensuring that students receive services relative to English language development so they can better navigate our system and achieve at a much higher level. But I will get you the specific criteria that we used, especially as defined by federal law, because this is also part of the Office of Civil Rights requirements mm-hmm. that we have to adhere to. So.
Go ahead.
Okay, we're getting in now to some funding levels. These are per student amounts, and this first graph is formula funding. It's all the money that goes through the formula divided by average daily membership. Again, this is a student count without the weights added. And you can see the growth in this over time.
Starting at zero on that, on the left-hand
side. Right, and again, these graphs start in 1991 to show where we were pre-Measure 5. Again, though, this is not just local money, so to the extent that state resources to the formula made up for the shrinking of local resources into the formula as Measure 5 phased in, this funding continued to grow in those years. This next slide shows that same amount of formula funding, but this time per weighted student. So now we've added the weights in the denominator of that calculation. The pattern's not terribly different. Funding per ADM rose 92% over this period. Funding per ADMW, with the weights in, rose by just 79%. And what that tells us is that the share of, or that the percentage of weights have been growing over time, which you saw in that previous graph. And then this last one, which is extremely important, is that we adjust those funding amounts for inflation. And this starts to tell a very different story. You can see that as Measure 5 phased in those early years, the state money did not keep up with the reduction in local money to the extent that it compensated for it and for inflation in our schools.
And that's measured with CPI? You use CPI for inflation, or do you use a different number?
Representative Smith Warner, no, we don't use the CPI. It's a poor measure of what school districts buy. So we use a weighted average of salaries and benefits and supplies that Oregon schools actually purchase over time. So where we are, you can see the ups and downs in this. You can see the recession of the early 2000s, where we had a big drop in 2002-03, and then a little bit of catch-up. And then in 2008-09, we had gotten back to, not back to where we were before Measure 5, but up to about $3,500. And these are $90, $91. And then with the recession in the late 2000s, back down, and then started to grow out of that in recent years.
Representative Parrish?
Thanks. On those first few bars, the ones that are sort of pre-Measure 5, you know, Senator Monroe mentioned a week or so ago about, you know, before Measure 5 and 50, because I'd asked the question, if Measure 5 and 50 hadn't have passed, where would we be, and given all of the other inflationary costs? And I'm curious if those first few bars, if you have data, you know, Senator said that we were backfilling school districts that were just shutting down schools. So was the investment from the state that high because local property taxes weren't getting it done in school districts? I mean, I went to school in Oregon as a kid and certainly remember some of those days before 5 and 50 when school districts weren't offering a full calendar year then anyway. So were those investments higher because you had districts that were just shutting off school and the state was infusing money? Because otherwise, other than the recessions, I mean, it looks fairly, our investment looks fairly stable. That might not be at the growth level that people want, but I think I'm just curious if those first three bars are higher because we were having to infuse so much cash into local schools to keep them operational.
Co-chairs Monroe, Smith Warner, Representative Parrish, these dollars are both state and local. These are the formula dollars. And so in those early years, that was two-thirds of that money was local money. Mm-hmm. And what I think is clear is that back then there was a lot more local money in the system, but it was not distributed very evenly around the state. There were some districts that had a lot of local funding that the taxpayers voted upon themselves. Portland, Corvallis, Eugene are examples of those types of school districts. But there were also other school districts that were very low funded back then. These are averages, statewide averages. On average, it was higher back then, but it was the primary reason is that a lot of districts generated a lot of local revenue themselves.
Go ahead.
So a little bit about the small school correction, and you'll see in a few minutes the impact of this. Elementary schools that are both small and remote generate extra weights in the formula for their district. And the smaller the school, the more weights, proportionally more weights the school generates. And that the weights actually phase out as at larger school sizes. So when an elementary school gets up to, I think, 240 students, these extra weights are phased out completely. And when a high school gets up to, I think, 350 students, these weights are phased out completely. But in those schools that are in the range of 25 to 50 students, they generate a lot of weights. In fact, most of their weights come from this rather than from the characteristics of their student body. And so they generate a lot of extra weights, and it, which results in a lot of extra dollars for them through the formula. We have, as I mentioned, we apply this these added weights based on both elementary schools, which in this case we count as K through 8s. So you get middle schools in there, although we don't actually have any small middle schools in Oregon. When you are a small district with low student counts, you tend to have K-8 schools or even K-12 schools. So there are not any small middle schools in Oregon.
Representative Lively.
Thank you, Madam. So before we move, before Measure 5, when the districts were paying the majority of the money, so was there still, from the state standpoint, a balancing for the small schools and that, or how did they survive in those days versus today?
Co-chairs Monroe and Smith Warner, Representative Lively, this small school correction is a feature of our current funding formula that started in, I believe, 02-03. I don't know what sort of additional resources the state might have provided to districts with small schools prior to the current formula, but I think if you look back on the total funding levels of small districts, particularly rural ones, they were pretty low back in the pre-measure, pre-measure 5 and pre-funding formula days. That was, in fact, one of the impetus behind the potential lawsuit around our distribution. Yes.
Representative Wisnett.
Thank you, Madam Co-Chair. Mr. Reeder, we have two schools that have dormitories now, is that correct? Or how many schools do we have, and how does that come under this weight, this distribution, allocation of funds?
Co-Chair Smith Warner and Monroe, Representative Wisnett, we have, I believe, two is correct. Two districts that run schools that have dormitories, so the students live in the schools during the week and then go home on weekends. And the reason is for transportation. These are large districts with sparse populations, so students would be traveling a lot of time each day if they lived at home. They're treated just like any other district for the small school correction, for the weighting scheme. The real difference is that in the transportation formula, they can count some of their room and board expenses the same way other districts count transportation expenses.
Thank you.
And the other two pieces at the bottom here, we still have a couple of districts in Oregon that are high school only districts, and then the districts that feed students into those high school districts are elementary only school districts. And in the formula, we give an added weight for the high school districts. They get 1.2 rather than 1.0 as their base weight. And then the elementary schools get 0.9 rather than 1.0 as their base weight. Okay. The logic being it's more expensive to run high schools than to run elementary schools.
Senator Rublin.
And that's the question I wanted to come to. So is that a number that you came by after looking at the costs that school districts in general pay for elementary and middle school, that weight distribution, the 9.9 and the 0.1, 0.2?
Yeah. Co-chairs Monroe and Smith Warner and Senator Rublin, I think that's correct. And this predates my time here, right. But I think the crafters of the formula probably looked at spending patterns at the school level to see how much they spent per student and saw that they were spending less in elementary schools than in high schools. And I think the way they thought about it is, well, you have more types of programs in high schools, and you have lab equipment and other costs that you don't have in elementary schools. What I don't think they did is look at student performance and whether this was this is actually what was happening in school districts. It's another question to say if that's the most efficient way to use your resources if you're taking into account the student learning that you're getting from your programs.
Follow up?
And since it adds up to 1.1 weights, we assume that there are more elementary kids than there are high school kids?
Co-chairs Monroe, Smith Warner, Senator Roblin, I don't know if that's the case or not. There are very few students that are in these schools.
Right, that's true.
A couple hundred, I think, at the most. And so it's not something we've studied terribly carefully.
Fair enough.
We certainly could do the student counts if you would like.
Yeah.
So my two quick questions about the weighting, particularly for small schools, is number one, so the weight is mostly for individual schools, not for whole districts, according to this. Is that correct? Ish.
Representative Smith Warner, it's based on school level, school sizes, but the resources are paid to the districts. We don't pay schools, we pay districts.
Right. Thank you. That's what I was just trying to kind of firm up in my head. And then number two, could I request that we get some data specifically about the schools that qualify for this and what their populations are? If we could get that kind of, there's always all sorts of grumblings about various small schools. Most of them are very, I think everyone would agree, are very reasonably receiving it, and there are some that we always hear some grumblings about. And so I would appreciate just seeing specifically who is getting this, who is getting this weight.
Of course.
Thank you. Did one of you guys? Okay, go ahead.
So just a couple other things about the formula. In addition to what we call ADMW, when we get to the point in the formula where we actually calculate how much money districts get, we take the larger of the current year ADMW and the prior year, and we call that ADMW extended. And so if you're a district that's losing enrollment and your ADMW keeps going down over time, you will get funded at a slightly higher level, the level you had in the prior year. The logic there is that as your enrollment goes down, your costs don't really go down at that same rate. You have certain fixed costs and other things that potentially prevent your costs from going down that quickly, and therefore we give that 1 year sort of grace period to districts where their funding doesn't go down quite as much as it would have.
Senator Monroe.
Yeah, we all know that teachers at the top of the salary scale, and they usually reach the top around 14 or 15 years of experience, get paid basically double or sometimes even more than double what a starting teacher gets paid. I don't particularly like that, but that's the way it works out. And so if you have a district that is growing fast or growing at all, has more younger teachers because they're hiring new teachers each year and so on. If you have a district that is a declining population, then all other teachers tend to be at the top of the salary schedule, so it's more expensive. That's the reason for that change or that calculation.
So there's also one other calculation in the formula, and again, it relates to teacher salary. And what it really is the only feature in our formula that makes the per ADMW funding amount vary across districts, and we call it the teacher experience adjustment. And the way it works is we calculate the average years of experience of all the teachers in the state and then also do that for each district. And if the district's average is larger than the statewide average, the district gets an additional $25 per weighted student for each year that its average is above the state average. Similarly, if it's below the state average, you get $25 less per weighted student. So you'll see the impact of that in this next slide. And this slide, each of these bars is a school district.
I love this.
And the gray bars show the amount that the district raises from their own local revenue. And the red bar is the amount of state money they get through our formula. And you can see when you add them together, it's fairly flat. That's across all districts. They're all around, and this excludes the transportation funding and the high-cost disability funding. It's around $7,000 per weighted student here. And the little bit of variation you see across the top there, that's the impact of that teacher experience adjustment.
And that's 197 districts, correct?
That's 197 districts. So there's a few things that are real interesting going on in this graph. You'll see that at the far left end, there's a couple districts that have very, very little local funding. Ashwood, French Glen, Santiam Canyon, and Harper. All very small districts with very small amounts of local revenue, on the order of $300 to $400 per weighted student they raise locally. And so they get most of their money from the state. On the opposite end, you'll see four districts that don't get any state money at all. And that's because they raise more money locally than they are guaranteed by the formula. So Neocony, Seaside, Nestucca Valley, and Jewell are those four districts. And for Neocony and Seaside, it's primarily they have a lot of property relative to the number of students they have, because there are a lot of second homes and commercial property, particularly in Seaside. So a lot of tax revenue relative to their student population.
And are they able to, is their per student number whatever they raise?
Yes. It is. The state does not take that back. A number of states have tried that, and it has not gone over well.
I wonder why.
But I do think it's interesting to look, though, that it is not that much above what our general per student number is.
Right. Those districts are a little bit above, but not dramatically.
Not inordinately.
Not
yeah.
dramatically.
I think there was a time when they were more dramatic. Was there not? Because there used to be more forest timber money coming in.
Yeah, I mean, both Jewell and Nestucca Valley, the reason they're up there is they get state timber money.
Yeah.
And that money goes to where the cut actually happens. It's not spread around. And so they have a lot of local revenue due to that state timber that's harvested within their boundaries. It may be, you know, in the past when those harvests were larger, they may have had a dramatically higher amount of money relative to other districts. And you'll notice the one bar that goes up really high there on near the left end, up to $8,000. That's the Druzy School District. And the reason they're up there is that they have two teachers in Druzy, and they both have over 40 years of experience. And the statewide average is 12. And so they're getting a lot of extra money through that experience adjustment. Now, when those two teachers retire and they hire brand new teachers, they're going to, that money will come back down. So you see that other than those blips due to variations in teacher experience, Oregon really has equalized its funding, its formula funding, per weighted student.
And I would argue that I think it's useful. It supports more experienced teachers, I think, because one of the concerns about employment in general is, you know, you boot out the more experienced, higher paid folks to bring in the less expensive folks, and this acknowledges that there is an additional cost to having highly qualified, highly experienced teachers, and there is a value to that, and we put a dollar amount on that value, and I think that's a great idea.
Okay, so the next graph I'm going to show you, this one that we're looking at is formula money per weighted student. I'm going to show you one now, formula money per what I call actual student, because these are real kids. The weights are not real kids, but so this is formula funding per student enrolled on October 1st, which is a common measure that both we and the federal government use in counting enrollment. And again, the gray bars are local revenue, and the red bars are state revenue. And you can see that until you get about two-thirds of the way across, there's not a lot of variation in the total. There's some variation in the share coming from local and state sources, but the level of the two bars combined is going up, but not dramatically. But then they start going up dramatically, and that's the impact of this small school correction. And you can see the box there with the arrow. There are 76 students, or 76 districts, I'm sorry, to the right of that arrow, and all of them get money from the small school correction. Now, the ones that are just slightly to the right of the bar, or of the arrow, they get a little bit more money because their school sizes are bumping up against the limit, and so they're getting close to the phase out point, so they just get a little bit of money. But as you get over to the right hand end, these are districts that are getting very large allocations of extra weights because their schools are 5 students or 10 students or 15 students. And so you get all the way out to the right hand end there, and I don't know who that is. But they're getting almost $70,000 per student through our formula because they may have, you know, 5 students, but they get 30 extra weights from the small school correction.
I used to have brothers that had 1 student.
So it's easy to say, wow, look at how much money those districts are getting, until you realize that there's only less than 3% of the students in the state are in those districts out there on that right-hand end. So it's the differences in funding per student are very large, but it's a very small share of all the students in the state.
You can offer them scholarships to University of Oregon.
Community college. That's a cheaper way to deliver their high school.
Okay, so the next few slides I'm going to go through quickly because later in the department's presentation, you'll get some more details on these. These are what we call carve-outs. This is money that comes out of the state school fund before the dollars are distributed through the formula. And so they are taken out for specific uses, specific programs, very often for specific groups of students, before we distribute money through the formula. And so you can see, and I'm not going to describe these programs in any detail, partly because you'll get it later, and partly because I don't know the level of detail that they really need to be described well. But we have a speech pathology program that is intended to increase the number of speech pathologists in the state. It's $150,000 taken off the top of the state school fund for that purpose. Before we distribute the money.
Just $150,000 total, not per district, not per anything?
That's right.
Just $150,000.
Per biennium, yes. Talented and gifted program, also a relatively small amount of money statewide for those particular students. Some dollars so that school districts can provide a nationally normed assessment for their high school students. SAT and ACT, I believe, are what? Oh, and PISA. This is currently PISA. Okay. PSAT. I'm sorry. The pre-SAT for 10th graders. In addition to the small school correction that we talked about, there's a separate program that we call the Small School District Supplement Grant. And that goes to small districts that have small high schools. And it's distributed on a per ADM basis, not per ADMW. And I believe when it started, it was at $600 per high school student. it was in recognition of the higher costs in high schools, even beyond what they're compensated for in the small school correction. And I don't recall, this has been around for maybe three or four biennia. And it's relatively, it's $5 million statewide, so it's, although that $600 per student is not a trivial amount of money. So it assists those smaller districts. Some money for youth corrections and juvenile detention programs comes off the top of the formula. A couple programs related to school capital needs. The facility grant program has been around for quite a few years, and it was intended to provide resources to schools or to districts that had recently built new schools or did major renovations under Oregon or under the Oregon Constitution. At the time, districts couldn't spend capital bond money on things like desks and lab equipment and those things you need to furnish a new building. And so this was put in place to give some extra money to those districts so they could purchase those things.
Yep.
The amount of the grant had been $12.5 million for quite a few years. It was reduced to $9 million recently. Part of the reason is the Constitution has been changed so that districts now can use bond money to buy those furnishings. And so some have argued that the facility grant program really isn't needed anymore. The purpose for which it was put in place doesn't really exist. Others have argued, well, districts still have those resource needs. So I don't know if it's scheduled to be completely phased out or whether that is a biennial decision that has to be made by the legislature. And then the next one is a new program, which was started a couple of years ago. It's called the Oregon School Office of School Facilities. It's a we call it the AWESOME program, the Oregon School Capital Improvement Matching Program. And what it does is when districts pass a bond levy to do new construction or renovations or repairs, they can qualify for a state grant, a matching grant that is funded through some bonds that the state sold last biennium. And it also created an office at the Department of Education to administer that program. And it, you may hear more about that later in the presentation, but it has been, I think, in people's judgment, an effective program for districts who in the past have had trouble passing a bond levy. We've seen districts who have had a series of failed bond levies who have now been able to pass a bond levy, and part of the reason that has been touted for this program is that they can go to their taxpayers and say, if you pass this bond levy, we'll get X million dollars from the state that goes along with that, and it makes it a more attractive bond levy to their voters. A couple more that you'll hear more about later. Pediatric nursing facilities to help fund nursing facilities. And I don't know a terribly large amount about this program myself, but you will get more about it later. And then long-term care and treatment facilities in Oregon that the education component for students who are in these facilities, about $23 million biennium going to pay for the education of those kids who are in those facilities, and very often in a facility that's in a different school district in which they live. And some of them are residential facilities. And then really two of the larger ones, the high-cost disability grant, which gives additional payments to districts that have students on IEPs that have very high costs of serving them. They may need a personal assistant the entire day or other very expensive care and treatments while they're at school. And so we have this fund to reimburse them for those added costs. Right now, I think the reimbursement, the intent was to reimburse them fully for costs above $30,000 per student. The reimbursement rate is about 69 cents on the dollar today. But that's up from about 31 cents a few years ago because of an increase in the size of that fund.
Representative Parrish?
So this is that piece where theoretically we're providing nurses on campus for kids individually, that health care in the classroom component. Is this the only dollar amount that we can attribute to that, or do we think that somewhere else in the IEP waiting there are additional health care dollars that are being paid for with ed dollars?
Co-chairs Monroe and Smith Warner, Representative Parrish, the students who would qualify for this got the first weight in our funding formula. There is some federal dollars that are used for special education students, and then there are these dollars. So, but as is clear, it's not sufficient to fully cover the costs for those students. Back to your point earlier that some students on IEPs don't require an additional $7,500, and some are much higher than that. The logic behind giving the same weight for all types of disabilities is that system-wide they tend to average out, or district-wide they tend to average out. But it was recognized that these very high-cost students, they are so high that that those districts don't get sufficient, that averaging simply isn't sufficient. And so there's this extra money to take to provide additional services to the very high, for the very purpose of not needing to use general education dollars for that kind of care.
So in that weight, though, if we were back on that screen, and there are however many thousands of kids in that weight, how much of those dollars that are not this $70 million do we think are actually health care being delivered in the classroom with those dollars? So, like, my son was not getting health care in the classroom. He was getting writing support. That's not a health care item. But when you're talking about kids on IEBs because they have health issues as part of their learning issues, and then we're delivering things that if any other real-world scenario and they weren't in the classroom that morning and needed that service, it would be provided through their health care. Trying to sort of wrap my head around how much of our special ed budget really is healthcare dollars. And I don't know that we track that other than maybe this bucket right here, but that would be interesting for us, to better understand.
Co-Chair Smith Warner and Monroe, Representative Parrish, you're right that we don't track that, but you're also right that because this is a separate bucket and is accounted for separately, we could do some analysis that would give us a bit of an idea of what you're asking is how much of all of our dollars that we have available, both special education dollars from the weights, the additional dollars from these funds, how much of that is going to these very high-cost students. And you get a hint for it here that of all the dollars above $30,000 that districts are spending for those students, they're only getting reimbursed 69 cents. And so there's that other 31 cents that they're taking out of either other special ed dollars or general education dollars. So we could do some analysis around that.
I would
if you'd
appreciate
like.
That.
Okay.
And
Senator Rublin?
Yeah, the question is what do we count as health care dollars? You know, does the having the aid because the person has to be helped going to the restroom, is that health care? Or because some health care people say that's not health care because we do that with aides that are not nurses. They have special training. And so figuring out that is also an important part of this whole thing. It's always been a hard one because over 30,000. So you've already put four weights, basic, not quite four weights, into that child before you even get to start talking about this number because it's about at 7,000 apiece. Well, fully over three. So it's an expensive deal. And some of them, it's not a lot of Medicaid. I mean, it's going to be an interesting thing for you to find, because some of these kids, it's just the fact they have an assistant that's with them full time who is helping them hold a pencil. I mean, they can't exist in the school setting by themselves. And that isn't necessarily healthcare, but it's dividing that, because some of them are in healthcare facilities, actually, while they're getting this stuff. It just depends on the particular kid and student.
Plenty of them, it's adaptive technology that's very expensive.
Right.
It's outfitting the classrooms that they're in. There's whole other things.
But there is healthcare parts of that, but you're right, there are. And,
absolutely.
And we do get some of that money from the federal government. I mean, some of these kids are getting other money from the federal government for exactly those kinds of things as well.
Well, and a follow-up, I guess, is when we're delivering ABA therapy for kids with autism,
right.
Autism's a medical condition.
Yep.
And then in order to meet sort of the free and appropriate public education, we're delivering therapy services that are healthcare services to those children in an effort to help get them connected. You got kids who are on diabetes, and we're doing things with managing their insulin. And, you know, a good constituent of mine is a nurse supervisor in the Beaverton schools, and I had the experience to go and spend a day with her at all of her sites. And the sheer volume of healthcare services, and whether they were being delivered by an IA or whether they were being delivered by a nurse, because they didn't have enough nurses, they were using IAs and secretaries to deliver some of these services. There's a lot of healthcare in these dollars, and I'm really interested to see how maybe we can start asking school districts to track some of that so we can get a better sense of what's really healthcare and what's really education, because I think we have to at some point have a conversation that those dollars should come out of different buckets to accomplish those goals.
And to be sure about it, I mean, to really understand that we are doing better at schools in tracking those kinds of things that are healthcare and then getting reimbursed for healthcare things. So our teachers are asked to come do that kind of stuff. There's a lot of kids who are not special ed kids with respect to that, sir, who have special health needs that we're still working with. And hopefully we're getting some of that reimbursed now in most schools, because there's a medical deal out there that allows that to happen. So,
Mr. Wilson.
Madam Chair, members, you're either tomorrow or the day after, I think you'd get into some of this discussion, and Ms. Drinkwater and Mitch can talk a little bit more about some of the services, because Mr. Reeder is not an expert in this area. They're the experts, and they may be able to give you some examples.
That's
and
good.
Whether or not we can track the dollars or not is a separate question, but at least frame the issue for you.
And then the transportation grant, about $200 million a year goes out to districts to reimburse them for a share of their transportation expenditures. Those shares vary depending on how expensive or how much districts actually spend per student on transportation. Most districts get reimbursed 70% of their spending. More expensive districts get either 80% or 90%. Those are districts typically in large rural districts that transport students long distances and spend considerably more per student in doing that than districts that are in cities or towns.
Representative Wisnant.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Committee members, many sessions ago, I looked into this. I think there's really, we need to really look at this. I think there's savings or efficiencies can be involved in transportation. I think we need to look at incentivizing changes in transportation. I know that the good senator from the coast, contracted out his bus service and it didn't succeed completely. But I think there's opportunities out there that transportation is really expensive, and when you're only getting 70%, that seems strange for some of these districts. But I really think maybe not this session, but we in the future need to continue to look at the transportation grant and look for ways to incentivize it to make it better and cheaper. So.
And I know Representative McEwen had a work group on that in the interim that
right.
Senator Roble may have been on as well.
And part of it is that these are academic transportation costs. So it doesn't count athletic transportation costs. So there's some of these districts are spending a lot because they have a long ways to go with some of those kinds of things that comes out of their money. And so it is a big issue when you have large geographic districts with kids to get them to school. And we all know that they don't do well if they don't come to school. And we did have a time when we didn't have transportation for some of our kids, and a lot of them did not come to school. So it was very frustrating for us for a few years. So it's a biggie. And she did do a transportation because there's another group of students in the metropolitan areas who use the regular transportation there, which is, I think, a really good thing, but they don't get any reimbursement. So I was trying to figure out how do you help those people who are using public transportation to give a kid a pass, and how do you help with those? So I think this is an area where I agree we need to have a conversation. I know Caddy did a good job with trying to bring all those people together and figure out what they could come up with.
Maybe we'll try to get some of that information in before this committee after we get through the budget presentations. Go ahead, Mr. Reeder. Oh, sorry, Senator Monroe.
Yeah, I'd like to agree with Representative Wisnett that this is an area we need to look at. I've thought about it a lot. I've looked at the numbers. It seems to me that there's really very little. There's very little in the transportation formula to reward districts that find savings.
Yeah, yes.
And I think we always ought to reward districts that find more efficiencies in the way they deliver. And I don't think this formula does that.
Very good. Okay. Mr. Reeder.
Okay. Network of Quality in Teaching and Learning. You'll hear more about this. It's a program to improve teaching in Oregon, about $36 million in the 2015-17 biennium for that program. Some additional dollars for English language learners. This is in addition to the dollars associated with the weights in the formula. In an effort to improve training for ESL teachers and to improve outcomes for that group of students. As mentioned earlier, what we found is that students who exit ELL status prior to high school, their graduation rates are extremely high, very encouraging.
Senator Roblin.
That's really 12.5 million, right? Not 12. 1,500,000 million.
Well, yes, you're right.
Okay. I was concerned about the number. Thank you.
What's six zeros among
okay. I agree. They don't mean anything anyway.
You just fought your savings here.
No, keep it.
Yeah, that will keep it.
And then another carve out, this was actually a one-time carve out that allocated some money to allow students who qualified for a reduced price lunch to actually get a free lunch. So this one, this was one time in 15-17 biennium.
And was that the cost was 2.395? What did you say?
I believe that. Okay. I believe it was all distributed, okay. Yes.
It also garnered quite a bit of federal funds, if I remember right,
yes.
Too.
Yes.
And then the Oregon Virtual School District, which actually is not a school district at all, but a program that ODE has to provide to school districts content, or for lack of a better word, learning resources for online programs that school districts run, not just online schools, but the online type of a share of their curriculum that regular schools would use.
We're going to get more on this.
Yes, Representative Wisnett. We'll get more information on this further in the presentation.
I believe
well.
You will. I think right. I think one thing to remember is that the department has leveraged from private companies a lot of free software through the creation of this office or this ag program at ODE, and so it's been the $1.6 million price tag is quite small relative to the benefit that has been generated through private contributions of both their expertise and their software.
Okay.
Can I make a comment?
Sure. And then we're going to just try to get through the end of the, Mr. Reeder's part and then wrap
I look forward to hearing more about this. A lot of us are working on the open education resource for colleges. And in that presentation, we were told there is free online courses now from kindergarten to 12th grade. The Khan is one of the big institutions doing that. So I look forward to hearing more about this, Madam Co-Chair.
Great. Thank you.
Okay. Local option equalization grants. These are grants available from the state to certain districts who pass local option property taxes to enhance their K-12 programs. The way the program works is it targets school districts that have low assessed value per student. So in that sense, it equalizes their ability to raise revenue. For example, the program targets the school district at the 75th percentile of revenue per weighted student from their local option property tax. And if for districts who are below that, they get a grant from the state that brings their combined local option revenue and state grant up to a level that they would have had if their assessed value was at that 75th percentile. Now, that's sort of a complicated sentence, but essentially it gives them more revenue so that as though they had more taxable property in their district. So it provides a bit of an incentive for school districts to pass local option levies and then gives them those additional dollars in cases where they have low assessed value. We currently have a couple dozen school districts in the state that have local option levies, and right now 7 of them receive this equalization grant through the state. I just calculated the amount that we're about to pay to those districts, and it's $1.8 million going out to those 7 districts, I believe, this month under this grant program. And I believe you've been provided the list of those districts and their grant amounts.
Okay. Senator Monroe.
To get the local option, though, they still have to go to the voters and get approval.
Yep.
So you have to explain to your voters, if you vote for this, not only will it mean more money for our schools, but because we're a low property tax value district, we'll get most of that money back from the state.
That's correct. And then I believe this is the last slide for the carve-outs. This is a fund that was created to help defray the costs when charter schools close. And again, I think you'll learn more about this program later in our presentation. So,
Representative Lively.
So the question I have, and I appreciate, so all the carve-outs, all of these, so we have the state school fund, all these come off the top, and then we distribute what's left through the formula. So I'm trying to understand, so is there somewhere through all of this that we have that shows, outside of the formula, shows how districts gain or don't gain from all of these carve-outs and these special grants?
Co-Chairs Monroe and Smith Warner and Representative Lively, we do have that information.
Okay.
Yes, we could provide that.
Thank you.
Great. Representative Parrish.
Thanks. So where do sites like Youth Challenge fit into this? Is that considered some of the, I would not put that under Youth Corrections, or do you classify that there? And then some of those programs where we've got kids, I'm assuming, I just want to confirm that, like, programs where we have kids who have addictions issues or other types of mental health issues, they're in that long-term care and treatment ed dollars? Or is that more long-term health care and not necessarily issues around mental health or kids with addictions?
Co-Chairs Monroe and Smith Warner, Representative Parrish, some of those kids will be in long-term care and treatment. I mean, it varies depending on what their needs are. And so those programs, the programs themselves are funded through other means, but the education component of those programs are funded through these carve-outs. The Youth Challenge, I believe, Representative Wisnett knows more about that than I do.
It's under the Ben LaPine school system. They're treated like they're in the Ben LaPine funding.
And then who funds the residential side of that?
I think the military does.
I think it's the military department.
The military department budget. Military. Okay.
That's correct. Excellent program.
Okay. Oh, it's a great program.
Okay. Mr. Reeder, if you would summarize that, I think we're a little over time now. But
okay, so you'll see
that.
Here that all these carve-outs taken together are about $587 million. In 15-17 biennium. The bulk of that is the transportation grant. And so outside of the transportation grant and the high-cost disabilities grant, these carve-outs are a couple percentage of the entire state school fund. So the remainder of it goes through the formula, so really the bulk of it. And so here's the governor's recommended budget for the state school fund, the $8.016 billion. That is the level considered the current service level. And you can see the sources there. The money from the marijuana tax is the highest it's ever been.
Great.
And there we go.
Thank you very much. Thank you both, and thank you, colleagues. We will be back tomorrow morning at 8:30. Thank you for your willingness to stay and get through that section, and I would like to close the public hearings on Senate Bill 5516 and Senate Bill 5517, and we are adjourned.
Thank you.
And we are adjourned.
Thank you.